to the second edition of Local Energy Rules, a podcast about people putting together great community renewable energy projects and examining how energy policies help or hurt the development of clean local power. My name is Wade Underwood. In this week's podcast, John Farrell and I speak to Bill Moyer about a nascent community solar project in Vashon County, Washington. We ask Bill about his involvement with the project as a community organizer, delving into the frustrating regulatory barriers that have kept the project from coming to fruition and working towards a more accurate definition of community solar. Here's John and Bill now.
Bill, welcome to Local Energy Rules.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.
Well, I think it would be great just to start off with getting a little introduction from you about the project that you're working on.
Yeah. So in Washington State, there's a relatively generous production incentive that was, I believe, originally meant to be for residential solar and other renewable energy. And the legislature, a few forces, helped insert an additional piece, and they called it community solar, that would double that otherwise already generous incentive to a dollar rate per kilowatt hour for folks who would locate jointly owned renewable energy projects on public facilities.
And just for some context, Bill, the a dollar rate per kilowatt hour is in comparison to what maybe you pay for electricity, somewhere between 6 and 10 cents a kilowatt hour.
Exactly. So folks at working, you know, putting systems on their houses, we're going to get 54 cents a kilowatt hour per year, and for the length of the incentive period, which is till at this point June 2020. And now I should also add that that's an incentive that is more generous to those who buy panels and inverters or other equipment that's produced in Washington State. So it was also a green jobs package and an economic development package, the state considered it such. And there was a much smaller, less generous incentive for folks who just got the cheapest panels they could get, put them up on their house.
And the incentive then is the fact that it's there and that it can apply to community-based projects is, I think, a large part then in what has led you and the Backbone campaign to have an interest in developing a community solar project?
That's right. And the, you know, as a community organizer, I feel that, you know, as part of my obligation is to help help the community take advantage of opportunities. The other thing that's more foundational about it, though, is I had a very interesting conversation one night with a waste to energy entrepreneur, and he said to me that he goes into a community and he looks for a waste stream, and then he looks for unused industrial capacity. He brings them together, he makes money, the community's happy, etc. This has had a pretty profound influence in my thinking in regards to what is community organizing, how to pick projects, and as an activist community organizer. And I'm thinking about waste streams more broadly than my friend Bob was. I'm thinking about waste streams in terms of where is equity and wealth leaving our community, and how can we redirect it back towards the community. So whether that's interest and fees we pay to Wall Street banks that could otherwise be going to local, you know, credit unions or cooperative banks, or money we pay even in taxes for food lunch programs that are going to agribusiness rather than local agriculture, and in this case, money that we pay to utility companies that are often transnational corporations for energy that otherwise could be either produced locally or not use via conservation and by employing, you know, local contractors to do conservation work on houses. So that's sort of at the foundation of why I was interested in community solar. I felt like it was an opportunity to stop this leak of equity in our community. I have to say, though, that the process of being engaged in the state program in Washington State has taught me a great deal about the limitations of state programs that try to do too much.
Bill, let's circle back to that in just a minute. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the project that you're hoping to put together and how it fits within that idea of community solar, or you know, what you've intended to do. And then let's talk a little bit more about that concept of, you know, what is community solar and how do we keep projects true to that definition.
Do you mind if I start with the actual, what I think actual community solar is?
Please do.
Okay. So there's a guy named Gary Neistat who's out in Ellensburg, Washington. He works with the local utility. He created a project where folks in the community could buy pieces of or proportions of a solar array. The kilowatt hours produced by their portion of the array are credited onto their utility bill. It's called virtual net metering. That is, in my estimation, is actual community solar. Those people will stay, they invest, they continue to own, and they continue to benefit indefinitely from their investment in that array, and they can continue to expand their investment over time, and it's really distributing the ownership of local distributed renewable energy production. And it's allowing people to collaborate together to do what they couldn't do on their own, but do it as a community.
So what then are examples you see of things that perhaps masquerade as community solar but don't fit that definition?
Yeah, so the dollar rate incentive for the what's called community solar in Washington State by the legislature is trying to use, I believe, the values and the appeal of this thing called community solar, and for something that is really citizen financing of renewable energy on public facilities. I am all for citizen financing of renewable energy on public facilities. It just becomes very confusing when you don't call it that. The utilities were very resistant. The large utilities in Washington State were very resistant to virtual net metering. And, you know, I'm currently in exploration to try to figure out why is that and what can we do about it. But the current law that Backbone Campaign has been trying to, and the incentive program that we're operating within to make something happen in our community is defined by our obligation to put this on a public host, which is great. We're partnering with our county transfer station, a former landfill. It has a energy appetite that will not even be, even if we put a 150 kilowatt array there, it wouldn't be sufficient to power the entire place. And we're proposing to do a 66 kilowatt array that folks would in the community would invest in the purchase of. We would lease this land from the county at getting a good deal from them. They would net meter, meaning all the electrons produced would not be purchased by them from us, but they would be they would go through their meter, and they would get credit on their power bill, while the folks who've invested in the array would collect the incentive check each year until the end of the program.
So just to make sure I understand, when you construct this array on this transfer station, people have invested in shares in this project. The electricity goes as a credit to the county transfer station, but it's the incentive, the state incentive, that dollar rate per kilowatt hour that gets distributed to all of the investors in the project.
That's correct. Nice work. This stuff gets so complicated so fast, and my difficulty with these programs is that very thing. If it becomes so complicated that people's eyes glaze over while you're trying to get them to participate, it makes it very difficult for the programs to succeed.
Bill, when we were kind of emailing back and forth, you had mentioned that there were some definite barriers to this project being carried out. And I think you've maybe already touched on a few of them here, just with things being complicated in the limitations. But could you talk more about some of those specific barriers?
With an incentive period that ends, right now it's our incentive period is slated to end June 30th, 2020. Once you go through the process of identifying a potential site, making sure the engineering is going to work, which could take a great deal of time. It took more than a year and a half to find an adequate site that where we could negotiate an agreement with that local bureaucracy to put the system. Once you go through that process, and then you have to get through other state processes, the closer you get to the end date of that incentive period, the less return on investment people are going to get, obviously. So there's a problem with an incentive period that is good for the people who come in early, but bad for the people who come in late. Because this is a quote-unquote investment, and it's not just literally financing of systems for public facilities that would then become the property of those public facilities, those public hosts. This investment element triggers the participation and the oversight of what we in Washington State call the Department of Financial Institutions. It's the state-level version of the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC. So that means organizers like myself, who probably don't have a background in securities law, are subject to the rules of this regulatory agency and have to get legal assistance to apply and navigate a way through various exemptions in order to get their projects forward.
It's very complicated, and there are certainly things that I've been working on and that we are interested in exploring to make that financing easier. In terms of mentioning that with the Department of Financial Investment about the complexity for people to invest in this project, how are people able to invest in the project? Have you worked out those details about how people are able to invest and kind of what niche you've been able to find that's going to let your project move forward?
Yes. Well, it is marginal because we're right on this threshold where folks who invest in our project will probably get their money back and something. But they're, we're 2.5 years into the incentive program, it's already very marginal. So we'll see. The way we worked it out through our Department of Financial Institutions and dealt with that component, I should clarify that people can organize in a variety of ways. One of the ways that people organize is by starting a limited liability corporation, LLC. It turns out that only 5% of our incentive program was allowed to be for people who organized under that umbrella. So we had to switch from organizing under that umbrella, which was mostly tapped out in our state, to organizing in a much looser sort of co-op model where everybody has a proportionate ownership. And the other thing that I'm trying to get to here is that because of it's considered an investment and it triggers the oversight of the Department of Financial Institutions, all of a sudden you get into a situation where they're saying that projects can only mostly be funded by sophisticated or accredited investors. So we've worked through this by using our 501c3 umbrella and applying for an exemption from the Department of Financial Institutions so that we can offer shares in our system that are, to anybody who can put in $1,000 chunk, or more. So we've worked through using a 501c3 to get an exemption from those Securities and Exchange Commission or Department of Financial Institution rules, so that everybody qualifies for a fixed amount, like a 10-year rolling incentive period, and then the end date, what happens at the end is that the system automatically transfers to the ownership of the public host.
Would that help then with some of the, like you said, the securities rules or the investing rules in terms of, you know, people are no longer taking an ownership share, but sort of, you know, buying a share that's of a limited time period?
I believe so. Now, I'm not a securities lawyer for sure, but I believe that with a few strategic parameters placed on the transfer of the, you know, how if ownership in the share can be transferred and what happens at the end. See if, you know, I believe that we could start clarifying this and not become subject to Department of Financial Institution rules.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that that in seeking an exemption from the securities rules and from the state rules using your nonprofit status, that you're able to get around that those otherwise heavy requirements for basically wealthy investors in the project. Are there other limitations that come along with following that alternative rule?
The extra generous incentives for in-state production makes sense to me as someone who would like to see a more aggressive, you might call it an industrial policy or economic development, local jobs policies, but there wasn't enough future potential for other for people to continue to come and enter the market, which would create an adequate level of competition for pricing in the state that would make it a good value for people in the state to purchase in-state equipment, panels, etc. So now we've got, for instance, we've got one company that's doing pretty well, and you know, other companies that are coming in and failing, or their inverters aren't good, or whatever. And and if we had a rolling incentive period where everybody who participated got that 10 years, you would still have room for new players to come into the market. And the price, I can't demonstrate with evidence that the price is being, you know, artificially inflated in Washington State by the Washington State producers, but I wouldn't be the first one to infer that that's actually happening.
So what you're saying is that, you know, that with the generosity of this incentive and the fact that it focuses on local manufacturing of the components of the solar project, that it may be that these producers are inflating their prices knowing that the people who are buying them are getting this fairly rich incentive.
That's right. They can do the math and figure out where's the sweet spot for folks who, if you wanted to get the out-of-state panels, and how many years would it take for you to get your investment back, versus if you get the in-state panels, how many years will it take for you to get your investment back? It's not hard to do that math and figure out where you can price in order to motivate folks to buy the in-state panels.
So, you know, I always want to ask people about when they're working on a project, a specific community solar project, community wind, or any of these kind of local energy projects, whether or not it's something that can be replicated. And I think you've already addressed this pretty well, that the nature of the Washington State incentive is such that that window of opportunity to do a project in a similar format is fading very rapidly. You know, maybe I should put the question this way, that if the incentive was changed so that everybody in that time period that the incentive is available till until 2020 could access it over a 10-year period, or maybe the incentive would be, you know, modestly reduced, you know, from year to year, but still give people that 10-year window, do you think that other people could set up a project like yours and do a real community solar project, you know, somewhere else in Washington State?
Absolutely. I think it would make all the difference in the world if people could get that 10 years of incentive.
So Bill, knowing what you know now, sort of about community solar and as it's happening in Washington State and the given the current situation of the project you're working on now, do you have any plans, or does the Backbone campaign have any plans to get involved with any additional projects?
If anything, it's to get a little pilot going, probably less ambitious than we originally started, happening to deepen that relationship and that alliance with this this large county, King County, and to utilize that as leverage in convening a group of stakeholders to go into our state legislature and fix this very flawed legislation.
So, Bill, you know, I think we've covered a lot of the roadblocks that you've encountered in this two-year process of trying to figure out a community solar project. Can you leave us with something optimistic, with something hopeful, with something that you think is in our favor when it comes to finding ways to make that connection between, you know, as you, I think, put so eloquently earlier, you know, where are the places that dollars are leaving our community that we can actually capture ourselves? What is there to be hopeful for with community solar?
Well, I think that though it's painful, I think the impulses are there. I guess we just have to learn from the failures of programs as well as the successes of programs. And I would say one very successful program is the Ellensburg model, championed by a guy named Gary Neistat, that is actual community solar using virtual net metering. And then I think we should see what are the obstacles to pushing more models like that forward. And then if we're going to do citizen financing of renewable energy on public facilities, that we call it that, and that we simplify it, because it's a great idea that citizens could come together and get a return on investment for making sure that all of our schools and all of our libraries and our transfer stations and city halls are using green renewable energy.
Bill, thank you so much, and thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. We really appreciate it.
That was John Farrell, Wade Underwood, and Bill Moyer. Bill is the executive director of the Backbone Campaign and continues to work on the community solar project in Vashon County, Washington. For questions or comments, please email jfarrell@ilsr.org with Local Energy Rules Podcast in the subject. John's Twitter handle is John F. Farrell. This podcast was published on February 7th, 2013. Thanks for tuning in.